Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to Space Junk Podcast. My name is Annie Hanmer, and this is part two of the episode with Tom Standage, who's the deputy editor at The Economist in London. In this episode, we get more deeply into a discussion about Tom's experiences over his career as an editor and journalist in the field of science and technology. I hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, you can look at other episodes on the podcast app where you found this one. You can also head over to YouTube and watch this episode in video form. Just look up the Space Junk Podcast on YouTube and you should be able to spot the same logo and find this episode. It's part two with Tom Standage.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Now, you are a specialist in science and technology and a writer on that subject. So I wanted to begin by asking you, what interests you in science and technology, and what got you interested in the first place?
So I do a bunch of things that might not appear to be that similar to each other, but there is a logic to it. Basically, I grew up reading a lot of science fiction, and I was 11 when sort of home computers became available. So I got my first home computer when I was 11 and started programming. So I was very much that generation of people in the 80s. And I read a lot of Asimov, and I read a lot of Arthur C. Clarke. And I went to Oxford in the late 80s because I wanted to build AIs. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go and build robots that could talk. And I spent my teenage years, I wrote programs that kind of did chatbots, conversation holding, poetry writing, that kind of stuff. So that's what I was really interested in. I wanted to kind of know what the future was going to be like, and I wanted to make that science fiction future sort of happen. And you see this a lot today, actually, that the technologies that people are developing are, if you want to see the future, look at science fiction, because the smart speaker, the Amazon Echo, is basically the computer from Star Trek. And Jeff Bezos is a massive Star Trek fan and said, I think we should build that thing. Similarly, Elon Musk is building stuff that he's read about in sci-fi. And in his case, he names the drone ships after ships in Ian M. Banks' novels. So there is this sort of motivation among people with an engineering mindset that, they grow up reading this kind of science fiction. They're really interested. I was always into astronomy when I was little as well. So you want to kind of go and get involved in building that future. Then what happened, of course, is I discovered that AI didn't work, because AI didn't work in the late 80s. It's only really started working in the last 7 years. As a confluence of lots of new technologies, new techniques, the fact we've got more data and so on. So I couldn't do that. And instead, the internet had appeared, and I learned how to use it as a student. And then I realized that the British media didn't have anyone who knew about the internet. And so I started pitching stories to The Guardian and The Independent and other newspapers about this thing called the internet. And there was lots of interest in that. So it was basically my ticket into journalism. But then it turned out that there were all these supplements in the newspapers. It was the 1990s, and it was the papers were making a lot of money from the advertising from the internet service providers and the modem manufacturers. It was big boom area. And I thought to myself, this is great, but this is not going to last. And what I really need to do if I'm going to stay in journalism is go from covering this, this boom. This is an important subject, but I need to kind of be a serious science and technology journalist. And I have, a degree in, at the time you couldn't actually do computer science at Oxford. You had to do it with engineering or with maths. And I'd done it with engineering. So I had done a lot of physical sciences. and a lot of maths, and as well as the computer science. And so so I then applied for a job at The Economist to cover science and technology. And it's probably, you know, one of the most enjoyable periods of my career when I first went to The Economist. And I just wrote about basically astronomy, space probes, you know, space startups, because there were a bunch of them then that failed. And then, you know, the insides of microchips, materials science, you know, basically anything that wasn't biology, unless it was computational biology or genetics, which is kind of closer to my part of the map. So it was my ticket into journalism and then into science journalism. And then I've been at The Economist ever since, doing, you know, science and technology and futurology journalism. But this is the place where it all kind of joins up, because you've got the sci-fi there, you've got the journalism. And then I also have this great interest in history, and I've been writing history books since the late 90s, where I look at a particular period of history which is informative about the present. And the first book I did on this was called The Victorian Internet, and that's the period of Queen Victoria rather than the state of Victoria. This was basically telling the story of the telegraph network and how it spread around the world in the 19th century, and how the social reactions to it were exactly the same as the social reactions to the internet in the 1990s when the book came out. And I've basically done that joke again and again. The second book I wrote was about the discovery of the planet Neptune, and the Neptune file, as it was called. And essentially, Neptune was discovered, you know, through this process of mathematical analysis. Two mathematicians figured out that it had to be there because the orbit of Uranus was irregular, and they figured out where roughly it might be. And then one of them, you know, predicted it absolutely right. And so the planet was discovered. So it was a bit like the radial velocity discovery of planets, where we can infer that the planets are there from the behavior of the stars, even though we can't see them directly. And only much more recently we've been able to do direct imaging of exoplanets. So I've also had this interest in talking about the present and the future through the lens of the past. So how does all this join up? And I think it's because if basically the thing that drives me is I want to live in the future. I want to understand the future. I want to know what it's going to be like. And that there are three ways to do that. The first is to look in the past for historical analogies. So I do that. The second is to go and find the edge cases in the present, the people who are making a difference. I remember the first time I met Elon Musk in 2003, and I thought, this guy is completely out of his mind. And every time I've met him since, of course, he has seemed less mad. Well, actually, it does seem a bit mad sometimes, but his whole kind of, yeah, I'm going to build these reusable spaceships and we're all going to go to Mars. The first time I heard him do that shtick, I was like, yeah, right. And then he has done all the things that he said he was going to do since then. He was going to make these reusable rockets. He was, you know, and so now he talks about Starship and all the rest of it. You've got to give him credit. Yeah, you know, he's done all the other things he said he was going to do. And he does this, you know, he built that massive battery farm in Australia. You know, he's basically being dared by the American government to build ventilators. Anyway, so the second place to look is in the present, in the edge cases, the people who are, this, you know, William Gibson idea that the future is unevenly distributed. It's already here, but it's unevenly distributed. So if you know where to look in the present, you can see glimpses of the future. And, you know, going to Tesla or SpaceX would be an example of that. And then the third place to look for the future is in the imagined futures of science fiction. So all of those things, actually, the journalism, the history, the science fiction, all actually versions of the same thing, which is I'm trying to figure out what the future looks like. And the one of the hats I wear at The Economist now is I run our futurology franchises. So we have an annual called The World In, and The World In 2021 is the next edition, which will come out in November of this year. So I'm the editor of that, and that means commissioning people to write about the future, but just the next year. And then we also have an annual that comes out in the magazine itself in the middle called The World If in July. And that's much more kind of wide-ranging scenarios about crazy things, you know, decades into the future, but as if The Economist is reporting from the future. So I very much enjoy doing that. So this sounds like a bit of a mixed bag of things, but from where I'm sitting, it all fits together perfectly logically.
It's perfectly logical to me. And, you know, as the person who runs the Space Junk podcast, I run it for the specific reason that there are so many disparate elements that I think are so interesting and come together in precisely the way that you've described, where it isn't that at the first glance they make sense, but when you find the common thread and you draw that thread and you bring them together, they make perfect sense. And so this is how I justify the sort of the junk on Space Junk podcast, which of course this isn't. And I wanted to zero in on this idea of trying to predict the future, which I love. I love the idea that The Economist is doing this project of writing about, you know, the world next year, but also writing as if we're already in the future. But I think something that you've written about before and that I agree with is that engineers and people working in technology are often really bad at predicting what it is that we're going to like.
Well, to be honest, most people are bad. I mean, everyone's bad at predicting the future. There are a few sort of super predictors who are very good at it, but most people have very big, you know, cognitive biases about what they want the future to be like, and they tend to kind of imagine the future that they want. Or in the case of engineers and innovators, they actually go and build the future that they want, and you know, that's the way they influence it. So I think yes, it is hard, but yes, a recurring trope in the history of science and technology is that the worst person to ask about what a technology will be good for is the person who invents it. And this, of course, is if you buy the idea that you have kind of single inventors. Generally, ideas are kind of around, and things get invented lots of times. Lots of people invented the telegraph. Lots of people invent the steam engine. It's just some people do a better job of, you know, commercializing it or making it work than others, and it's very much a sort of iterative process. So you very rarely have the sort of hero engineer character. You just get sort of people who are more driven than others. Samuel Morse was a very driven person. He wasn't a particularly good engineer, and in fact he had other people who did that kind of stuff for him. Edison was very smart and, you know, generally did know a lot of electrical theory, but then he figured out how to sort of industrialize the process of invention and get other people to scale up his ability to invent things. So yes, you do get this phenomenon. Edison is a good example of this. When he invents the phonograph, that's basically him pretty much. You know, he's got a couple of people in his workshop helping him, but that's basically him doing it. He predicts what it might be used for. And one of the things he thinks it will be used for is a sort of answering machine that goes by your front door. So when someone comes to visit you and you're not in, they can leave a message. And I don't know about you, but that's not something that ended up being, and the idea that it would be used to record music only occurs to people sort of a little bit afterwards. I mean, to be honest, the first phonographs were pretty horrible in audio quality, so you wouldn't have wanted to use them to record music. But you know, that turns out to be, so then he thought, well, maybe people will use it for elocution lessons, and there could be a sort of educational use of the phonograph. And again, that didn't turn out to be like a massive, it basically turned out to be something for music. And you get this time and time again, which is that people kind of, you know, they invent things and they think this will be used for that, and then most of the time it isn't. Most of the time people find other uses for stuff. The cool thing about the internet is the people who invented it were just kind of like, we need to just figure out how to get computers to talk to each other, and we need to do it in the most simple way we can so that we don't constrain the ways that people will think of using this in the future. And that's the genius of TCP/IP, and what, you know, Bob Kahn and Vint Cerf did was that they invented this in such a kind of flexible way that they didn't constrain future permissionless innovation on the internet. So I think that was good, because whether they knew it or not, they were sort of being humble about, you know, the fact that they didn't know what it would get used for, and they were just like, here's the standard, get on with it, everyone. So yeah, they did, and here we are.
Well, that's sort of a common thread that links together many really breakout companies. Like if you think about Google, Amazon, Facebook, Alibaba, all of those companies are not selling a thing. They're providing a platform through which a thing is sold. I mean, absolutely the same with Uber and, well, we've been using a lot here, Deliveroo, the food delivery services and so on. eBay, I mean, these are...
No, those are platforms. I mean, there's a separate thing, I think, of platforms. Yeah, so and platforms are built to do a specific thing. So they are, you know, Uber decided it was going to, you know, it's a marketplace that brings together riders and drivers is, you know, what Uber does. So yes, you can then use that same platform to bring together takeaway restaurants and eaters of diners. But yeah, I think it's a slightly, I think inventions are, platforms have to be built in a, they are businesses, so they're built in a different way. I think the interesting thing is this idea that, you know, people invent, you know, fundamental technologies and then don't really get how they're going to be used, and it's only when they get out into the world. And that's what I find really interesting about the history of technology, is this sort of social impact of technology and the social history of things, which is where the technology meets human nature. And what I find is very, very striking is that throughout history and going back, you know, the whole of recorded history, people react to technologies in very sort of similar ways. And I, you know, I think that's not surprising. I think that different technologies come and go, but they push the same old buttons in our Stone Age brains. And I think human nature hasn't changed, and we're basically the same sort of, you know, Neolithic, we're running the same Neolithic OS in our brains that, you know, people were for the last 10,000 years. So it's not surprising that Victorians react to telegraphs the same way that, you know, that people in, in the 20th century react to emails, and that Romans, you know, use social media in a way that looks very similar to to the way that, people send messages today. So I like finding these analogies, because it's basically the same joke, which is that the technology's changed but people don't. The reason we need to say that is because what tends to happen is that new technologies get blamed for bad things that people do with them. So you get like, oh, the internet means that, you know, people are doing this bad thing, which they couldn't have done if they didn't have the internet. But so cybercrime would be a classic example of that. It turns out there was cybercrime on the electric telegraph network. And in fact, the first cyber attack in history took place in the 1830s on the first ever network, which was the French telegraph network. It was the first national data network. It was built, Napoleon kind of got it started in the 1790s and 1800s, and then it was built to cover the whole country. And in the 1830s, there was a stock market scam that was being executed by basically doing side channel, well, traffic manipulation on this network. So that tells you that if you build a network, people are going to find ways to do bad things with it. And you shouldn't blame the network for like making them into criminals. There are just some people who always find criminal uses for technology. So what I was originally trying to do with that point, and the kind of moral panic that you often get around technologies, is to say, don't just blame the technology. That's a kind of easy knee-jerk thing to do. And actually, these behaviors arise because of the interaction between the way people are and what technologies let them do.
So that moral panic thing is kind of one narrative that we see cropping up again and again and again with new technologies. But as a journalist and working in this field, how do you think about constructing more complex stories around technologies? Because it would be so easy, as you say, just to say, oh, there's this new thing called TikTok and, you know, people are using it to like spread bad information or something. And you'd miss a whole aspect of it. You'd miss so much of the richness of the social interaction with this new technology.
So obviously the moral panic stories are kind of tabloid stories about, you know, internet, you know, leads to bad thing. Internet divorces, that was, I remember there was a moral panic about internet divorces, because the internet made it too easy for people to like find their old boyfriends and girlfriends on Facebook, and then like start messaging them again and saying, actually, I'm really annoyed with my spouse, and, you know, let's get together again. So that was like, let's blame the internet for the, you know, that's a kind of classic example of well, you know, they could have actually just got a phone book out before, and is this really a technology specific thing? You know, you could probably have been, you know, if back in the Neolithic period, you might like have said, well, I'm going to go to that village and look up my old girlfriend. So, you know, is this really blaming the technology? So you tend to get those reactions from, I mean, the Economist doesn't do those kinds of stories. Yeah. And I think one of the, when I was on the science pages, you know, one of the really enjoyable things about working on the science pages is the challenge. And it's a bit like writing a detective story, I think. It's kind of got the same narrative satisfaction to it as a Sherlock Holmes short story. But it's the challenge of writing a succinct description of a new discovery or a new innovation or the result of a new paper in a way that is comprehensible to ordinary readers who are not specialists, but is not offensive to specialists. So it's finding the right. So when I write those kinds of stories, I spend a lot of time talking to the researchers about, okay, the way I'm going to explain this is with this analogy or like this. And I remember talking to David Deutsch, who's the sort of godfather of quantum computing, about this once. And he was talking about how in a quantum computer, you set the, you know, atoms up in this superposition of states. So they're sort of, you know, they're locked together by this kind of quantum weirdness. And then you manipulate them by firing laser pulses at them. This is one of the ways you can build a quantum computer. And I remember I was trying to look for an analogy. And the analogy he came up with was, imagine you've got a washing line and you've got bottles of, you know, milk bottles hanging from it. They've got different amounts of water in them. When you wiggle the washing line at different frequencies, different milk bottles will wobble up and down, but, you know, depending on the frequency. I don't know if I ended up using that analogy, but that was the kind of conversation that I very often have with scientists, because they would want to get it right. And the really rewarding thing about this, and the period that I did it, and it's still the case today, when I ring up I wrote a piece for the Christmas issue of The Economist at the end of last year about basically the history of the architecture of the solar system. So, you know, planetary formation, Jupiter and the Grand Tack, the Nice model, all of these things that I'm sure you know about, basically how the planets got to be where they are today. And it was lovely speaking to all of the scientists involved in all of that. And it was, it took me back to, you know, when I did that kind of science reporting every week, because scientists always liked being rung up by The Economist because they knew we wouldn't get it wrong. We'd kind of not misrepresent what they were doing too much. And this is because we would work so closely with them to make sure that our explanations were accurate and comprehensible. But also something that they would very often say is that they would use our reporting of their work to explain what they did to their friends and family. They could say, look, here's what I do. And they could give them this Economist article and it would be right. A, in The Economist, and B, not wrong, and C, comprehensible. And so so for me, a big part of it is constructing a story in a way that is accurate, is not sensationalist, obviously, and not kind of being moral panic about the internet or whatever. And then I think joining dots and finding sort of here are three examples of this, or you know, this approach in this field is being applied in this field. So you know, I'm looking at the moment at the way that AI, machine learning, as it should probably be called, is being applied in fundamental scientific research. And of course, there's a lot of interest in whether it can accelerate coronavirus treatments and vaccine development and so on at the moment. But there's a whole load of work. There was a fantastic paper that just came out a few weeks ago by Collins et al. On the use of machine learning to discover new antibiotics. And it's a really, really clever approach, where they basically give the machine learning system the structure of a bunch of molecules and the kinds of bioactivity that those molecules have. And then it sort of predicts what other molecules might be able to do that. But there's no information about the mechanism in the middle. So you can't sort of, it takes away the humans would say, oh, well, what's the mechanism? This might work because that works this way. And the machine learning system has no, it doesn't know about biology at all. It's just doing pattern matching. So there's some really fascinating work being done. And so looking across sort of multiple, then similarly, in material science, there was a very interesting paper last year that predicted materials that might have certain properties based on linguistic analysis of a big pile of material science papers. So again, the machine has no idea about material science. It doesn't know what the periodic table is. It just says, oh, these words kept popping up with these words, so maybe you should try mixing this rare earth with this rare earth and you might get these characteristics. So I also like kind of that generalizing, using these very specific examples to illuminate a general trend in science and technology reporting. That's an important thing. And then there's the kind of, you know, where the technology meets society. So there's some, you know, obviously now that the internet is everywhere, you know, every story can be an internet story. But we've got our very good Asia technology editor Hal, who's based in Hong Kong, and he is doing reporting this week about how the surveillance systems that some countries have around that have them already, how they've been able to repurpose them and use them for basically tracking, you know, movements of people and assessing who's at risk of getting the virus and so on. And so it's that kind of combination of authoritarianism meets sort of, you know, public policy meets public health. And that's what makes all of this so interesting, that previously people like me were writing about computers and some people were interested in that and some people weren't. But now what these technologies can do affects everything and in all these unexpected political and social ways. And so, you know, that makes this this has become a much, much more significant, you know, topic, and it's everywhere. And it's sort of, I think it's amazing that, you know, China has used these apps that show a kind of red, orange or green code to say whether or not you can move around. And, you know, they've had Alibaba and Tencent build these systems that, and they can do that because they've got these, you know, big tech giants who will basically do whatever the government tells them. And they've got the whole country using them pretty much. So that has, you know, given them a tremendous advantage. But in the West, we would say, well, hang on a minute. You know, this looks an awful lot like surveillance. And yet actually a massive amount of surveillance is under these circumstances, a good thing to have. So, you know, how do we balance the public interest and the sort of civil liberties against the need to clamp down and be more authoritarian, as we just have been in this country where the Prime Minister is saying, right, I've asked you very nicely, folks, and you haven't done what you're told, so I'm now going to demand that you stay at home and make it, you know, you'll make it legally required. Yeah. Anyway, so technology touches everything, and that just means that's what makes it so interesting to write about.
I find what you were saying about machine learning and the value of the machine being that not so much in what it does know, but in what it doesn't know, that that yeah. ignorance that it has being its
exactly. It's not encumbered by the human kind of biases or judgments or I mean, you know, there are problems with AI bias where you train a recruitment system on your best employees and it turns out they're all white men and then it only wants to hire white men. But
yeah.
But in this case, you're just giving it, look, here are a bunch of molecular structures and here's a bunch of activities, and you're not constraining it by what as a human scientist you might think is, well, that would never work like that, you know. So that yeah. gives it kind of freedom to suggest things that, you know, a human might not.
But I think that's kind of an element that comes through in really good science reporting and technology reporting, which is that it's not telling the reader what to think, it's telling the reader what to think about. And I think in the way that you've explained how you construct these stories and so on, I mean, it's so important, as you say, that what is in the article is right. Because for most people, they don't go and read the original scientific paper or the treatise that was written by this person. They read the article that's published in The Economist. And so getting it right is so crucial.
That's another thing that scientists have said to us over the years, which is that, I mean, you know, there's so much being published everywhere, but
yeah.
but a kind of, if you, but as a kind of radar of what interesting papers are appearing in other fields, a lot of people use our science pages as a way of doing that. I mean, you can subscribe to Science and Nature as well, but there's just a lot to read there. So if you want someone to kind of look out for the most significant papers, then you know, that's a job we can do for you.
Yeah. But then in your reporting, you're pulling out the bits that the science can't answer. Which is the, what ought we do? What should we do? What's right? What's wrong? What's ethical? What's unethical?
Well, we do that in the leader pages. Yes, that's true. Yeah. And I think also, you know, scientific papers are written in a very specific conservative way. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, a paper will be interesting because it will allude to or cast light on, you know, some potentially much bigger question that the scientists may or may not feel they want to, you know, anything relating to looking for life on Mars with methane, for example. You know, you get these methane papers and the methane numbers from Mars just don't make any sense and no one really knows what the hell's going on. And behind every conversation you have with a scientist about that is like, so is it life?
Sure.
And they generally, you know, they're not going to want to allude to that in the papers that they write about it. But then, you know, when they're talking to the press, then you say, well, what do you think about this? And so, you're not going to get that from reading the scientific papers. You're going to have to fill that in yourself. And I think the questions a lot of people have about these sorts of things, you know, it's our job as journalists to ask the scientists and say, so what about that? Or to put that kind of speculation in the right context and give people the tools to sort of understand the debate.
Yeah, well, let's talk space then. And you mentioned Mars and methane and the search for life. When you're writing about space topics, is that the key interest? Is the key interest about life elsewhere in the universe?
I don't know. I think there's lots of interest. The key interest is there are big questions that we don't know the answers to, and we want to know the answers to. And that's true in every, you know, field of scientific research. There's just some particularly big questions when it comes to this kind of research. So, you know, are we alone in the universe? Is there life elsewhere? If we do find life on Mars, will it be genetically similar to ours? In other words, there's a theories that, you know, life emerges first on Mars and is then transferred to Earth. Or, you know, could life have evolved somewhere else? This is a big trope in science fiction, you know, is all life in the universe, you know, is there panspermia and the common origin of life, or do you get evolution of complex life separately in different places? You know, those are all big questions. Then there's sort of big exoplanet research is, you know, interesting for the same reason, because we're interested in knowing how widespread planetary systems are. But then there's also kind of big questions about the origin of the solar system. And one of the things that interests me about exoplanet research is that the light that casts on, you know, so why did we not end up with a hot Jupiter? What stopped Jupiter from going into the sun? And it seems the answer is that Saturn was right behind it, and you get this interaction, planet disk interaction. So Jupiter's younger brother was like, whoa, hold on a minute, mate, you don't want to go in the sun. And so we don't, and so Jupiter comes in about as close as the orbit of Mars and then goes out again. You get this grand tap. That seems to be kind of, there's quite a lot of evidence for that. That's an area where the looking at our solar system, which seems to be quite unusual, and looking at exoplanetary systems, they can cast light on each other. And and so I find that very interesting. So yes, there are these big fundamental questions, and there are, you know, there are obviously big fundamental questions in lots of fields, and in non-scientific fields, you know, in academic fields in general. That's really what drives, you know, that's what drives the scientists who are trying to answer the questions. And that's what drives the stories that you can write about them, which is that these are basically big mystery stories and here's a clue. and you can criticize the kind of the detective novel structure of a science story, which was there was a mystery, people couldn't figure out this, now there's a paper which suggests this, and the reason is this, and then you get this wonderful paragraph where you get to explain kind of what's different now from what we understood before. But you know, those are very satisfying stories to write and very satisfying stories to read, and so I think that's part of it too.
Now, as a journalist, how has your job changed over time? You're an editor now, and when you look back over your career, have there been big shifts? It seems as an outsider looking in that your job must have changed enormously over the last 20 years even.
Well, so it's weird. So journalism has changed a lot, but The Economist has, and The Economist, obviously we've added a lot of digital content, and I've been involved in that, and sort of digital product design and product innovation and so on. There's been another of the hats that I've worn as a, you know, as a member of the staff that knows about computers, because that's one, you know, that's what I did at university. So so that has happened, and obviously, you know, we have apps and newsletters and websites and all those, and make videos and do podcasts. And so in that respect, the activity of journalism has broadened, although it's still basically doing the same thing, asking questions of people and trying to make sense of stuff. And then the industry itself has gone through this very, you know, painful shift, because advertising, which used to go to newspapers and radio stations, now goes to Facebook and Google. You know, the peak was in 2008, and advertising has basically fallen off a cliff then. The Economist is very lucky, because we never had a business model that was absolutely based on advertising. We've always had a very large fraction of our revenue, and it's now nearly all of our revenue, but it's always been a big chunk of the revenue has come from the readers, from subscribers. So while advertising was there, we took advertisers' money and put lots of ad pages in The Economist, and it was great, and made, you know, lots of money. But we're still profitable now, and you know, we can be profitable just with revenue from our subscribers. So in that sense, we haven't been affected by the storm. The if you look at what's happened to other newspapers, there've been, you know, massive layoffs, lots of newspapers have shut down, lots of consolidation. And in fact, you know, one of the first desks that gets it in the neck is that, I mean, the foreign reporting generally does, and then the science desks generally, people go, do we really need this? You know. And so, you know, that's been a very scary thing. And we at The Economist, we have been able to benefit from this and take good people from other newspapers that have, you know, other publications that have been shrinking. So we're very lucky that we've been insulated from that to a great extent. So there's the kind of external structural change of the industry, both in terms of, you know, the impact of technology on how you do journalism, but also the impact of technology on how much money there is to do it. And then just, you know, within The Economist, my role has, you know, I've just done a number of different things. So I covered science and technology as a correspondent for the first few years, and then I was made tech editor. So I ran our sort of magazine within a magazine, Tech Quarterly, which was great fun. I did that for about 10 years. I was also business editor. Then I ran the back half of the paper, which is business, finance, science and technology. And then I ran all our digital stuff for a few years. And then I've been deputy editor for the past, 5 years now. And I've now kind of got this futurology franchise and sort of oversight of long form stuff and bit of product innovation. I think one of the kind of classic distinctions that's usually made that doesn't really apply at The Economist is between writer and editor. So the kind of classic, and this is particularly strong division in American journalism, but you know, the old joke is that all writers wish they were editors because editors have such power over their copy, and all editors wish they were still writers because they've kind of enjoyed going out there in the world and reporting, and you know, it was much more fun than being an editor and being stuck to a desk. The nice thing about The Economist is that everyone is a writer and an editor. So pretty much, in fact, I was editing the science pages of The Economist the second week I got there, because the science editor was away. And I had done, you know, they knew I could do it because I'd been an editor at The Telegraph before. But we don't have, so newspapers will have sub-editors who make copy fit to pages. We don't have sub-editors at The Economist. Everyone does it. We don't have, they also write headlines. We do that ourselves. Most newspapers have separate people who write the leader articles. Again, we don't have separate people to do that. The Economist, we all do it. And particularly under these sorts of circumstances where, you know, we're all having to kind of, improvise how we put the newspaper together remotely. The fact that everyone is a writer and everyone is an editor is sort of, you know, even more apparent. So that's kind of nice because we still get to do, and even the editor-in-chief, you know, even the most senior journalists at The Economist will get to do some on the ground reporting at some point, you know, during the year if they want to. And similarly, even, you know, quite junior correspondents get asked to sit in for a section editor and edit things. So in that sense, it's all a big kind of soup. And I haven't had to go through a sort of transition from being a writer to be an editor that I would have done if I'd been on an American newspaper, say.
Yes. Well, on that note, I think I'd better let you get back to it. And thank you.
You've been listening to Space Junk. To get in contact, head to Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok and look for @AnnieHandma. You can also email me on thespacejunkpod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to support this podcast's continued running costs, you can go to www.patreon.com/thespacejunkpod.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.